Hey everybody, we got a loaded podcast for you today. So I'm gonna get right to the ad so we can get right to the fun. All right. One sponsor that makes this podcast possible is Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. If you go in the old bank building, you'll go to Manskirt. You'll see Joe Fisher and his Manskirt. That's correct. That's what you can see him wearing. Now, they always are making seasonally inspired ales. They always get something different. That brewery is coming along more and more and more every week. In fact, they got the big brew in Morristown this Saturday. Their very popular Pfefferbach is coming back. They got new tables, chairs, artwork to check out in the tap room. They got another run of their porter cans coming up in a few weeks as well. So there's lots of happenings at Manskirt. They just had yoga night. And it's just a great brewery to go to and check out. Go to Hackettstown. Check out all three breweries up there and finish it up at Manskirt. Give them some love on Facebook, on Instagram. That is Manskirt Brewing. Okay. Now, we have another brewery that we also work with. I was just there the other day for Valentine's Day. We stopped by and we had a stout that was in a firkin on chocolate-covered strawberries and rose petals. It was pretty unbelievable, if you ask me. And that's Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. May have the best tasting room in all of New Jersey. Just go look at that mural on the wall. They just released Gluttony, which is their coffee stout, on draft in the tasting room Sunday. And this Sunday, they're going to be releasing Cafe Negro, or Black Coffee IPA. Yum. A pilot batch of a collaboration with the New Jersey Craft Beer for the AC Beer Festival. Demented's always got barrel programs, sour programs. They're canning more and more things. I just saw today on their Facebook, they just got barrels in from to do more barrel projects. So they are another brewery that's just, in the short time they've been open, they've grown and grown and grown and are doing cooler and cooler things. So please check them out on Middlesex, New Jersey. Go on Facebook, give them a like. That is Demented Brewing. Finally, we got Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. You could actually win prizes playing trivia to breweries like Manskirt and Demented and all different New Jersey breweries. Each week, I host at Tap House 15 in Jefferson, but if you're not anywhere near that, that's okay. There's a million different locations, maybe not a million, but there's a lot of locations that you can go to and play a little trivia. Even if you're in last place, you can win prizes to New Jersey craft breweries. You can win prizes to their actual restaurant. It's just a great time out. Each week, there's a bonus item to check out on Instagram and Facebook to get you points. So please go check them out at Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, this week on the podcast, it feels good to be back, even though Mike's back, yeah, I know. But and it feels good to just get some things out. We talk some comedy shows. We talk about Mike's trip to Disney. But more importantly, we have two guests on the show, two big guests. Zoltan Istvan, the leader of the Transhumanist Party, now running for governor in California, joins us on the podcast to come back. And he's just a fascinating guest. And then we have Red Bull Cliff Diver. Okay, Stephen LeBou, okay, on the podcast. And it's just crazy the stuff this guy's done before, too. So two fascinating interviews. Both could stand out on their own, but we're going to give you a double dose this week. So with that, guys, make sure you listen to us. Subscribe, share the podcast for everyone. We would love that. And give us a rating on iTunes. With that, everybody, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Zoltan Istvan. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Hey, guys, this is Stephen LeBou, professional Red Bull cliff diver. And you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
No, I was just getting ready. Mike Berlo, Welcome back, buddy.
Yeah,
you were nearly replaced, but you're back.
Yeah.
You're back all tan, looking relaxed. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before you're back to your miserable, downtrodden, want to hang yourself self. It's only Tuesday. You can't be there yet.
It's one of those. I can't even like pinpoint a specific thing will work at the same time. It was like, nah, this ain't for me.
But anyway, welcome back, buddy. It feels good. It feels like it's been a lot longer than it has. Like it's been like 2 weeks only, really. something like that.
Was it more? I know Kira was last week. No. Did we?
Maybe.
Because one of our guests canceled out the week before, so we didn't podcast. So it's been 3 weeks.
Wow. That explains my peaceful zen self and having had to deal with you for 3 weeks. But if you were tuning in last week was hilarious, man. Mm-hmm. I had this idea. I was like, I was going to bring my 6-year-old niece on the podcast and just see what happened. I'm like, this could go either way. This could be really fun, mm-hmm. or just like her being like, nah, you know, like not even talking. But
like me,
yeah. It turned out pretty fun. I think mm-hmm. I'm going to make it like a little like sub series. It's like, especially if like can't pick cast this week, maybe I'll grab Kira and do a mm-hmm. Kira cast episode 2, episode 3. You know, and I just like there was a point where I asked her like. My favorite part was when I had the pictures of, like, the evil people. Mm-hmm. One was, like, the mayor of Paw Patrol. One was Darth Vader. One was Donald Trump. And she had no idea who Donald Trump was. But yet she's like, he looks like he's telling people, he's yelling at them and saying, no, 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 no. I'm like, that's so accurate. And then she would have these weird, like, existential, like, answers. Like, you should make people feel good by not doing it. I'm like, this is, like... You know, brilliant stuff. It's so mm-hmm. like when you have a child like that, they just it's so pure what comes out. Like, there's no filter, no thinking. Mm-hmm. Am I going to sound stupid? It doesn't matter. And even she was like, "Let's check Twitter." I'm like, "What? Like you need
somehow
a job?
Have a Twitter feed? What?
you need a job?" She's like, "Oh, we got a viewer." I'm like, "What?" You know, but it was a lot of fun, and I think it's a great little mm-hmm. thing I want to do. Maybe one day I'll bring her on with me and you, and we can have like a contest, like you and you and Kira in some kind of test, and see who wins. Who's the prettier princess?
You know? I'm not a pretty princess. Yeah. We've been through this.
Yeah. Well, no one knows what they're talking about. Besides,
then why'd you bring it up?
Because I was going to say, who's the prettier princess? We can have a competition uh-huh. about Disney princesses. And she would probably do pretty well.
Mm.
I think she'd. She's big on Frozen. I don't know if she knows the classics. You might mop the floor with her in the classics.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is good to be back. It really is. Yeah. It's good to be back. We have an action.
We came close to not podcasting.
We came really close. and not because like we messed up or anything. I went to plug in our recorder and nothing.
Dead.
Won't turn on.
Flatline.
Batteries, charger won't turn on.
And we smacking it.
And we had an interview scheduled at 7:30. You got here nice and early, 7 o'clock. We were ready to go. Mm-hmm. The recorder just didn't turn on. And luckily, Joe Fernandez, coming up big, has a recorder. And you said, does anybody you know have a recorder? I'm like, Fernandez is the only guy I know. And you know, he lives about 15 minutes down the road, 12 minutes down the road. And his wife put it in the mailbox. We got back in time for the 8 o'clock interview. Mm-hmm. Just so happened the guy who was at 7:30 really wanted to do it at like 8:30, and this weird karma thing happened. So thank you, Joe Fernandez. Here's a free plug. Go listen to All in Your Heads podcast with Joe Fernandez and Mike Gaffney.
Add to it, we almost ran out of gas.
Oh, yeah. I might not make it work even to the gas station tomorrow. It's like an inch below E right now.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's running on the fumes of the fumes right now.
But, speaking of Joe Fernandez, Mike Gaffney, this weekend, I really had three gigs this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday, I was going to go to open mic, and I get in touch with Joe Conte, and we were going to go to the mic together. And somehow along the way, we ended up getting a spot on Scotty's New Talent Night, and it was awesome. I haven't been there in a while, and it was like almost sold out crowd. It was big and... They were fun, and it did like an 8-minute spot. It was really good, way better than an open mic.
Yeah.
But then Friday comes. Friday, I had the Dover Fireman fundraiser that I've been nervous about since I booked it. Basically, it's a big thing. It's 300 people. It's a big room. It's a new company. You know, like a new thing, and mm-hmm. these things can be
hit or miss.
These things can be tough to begin with. Most of them are tough. So you right away when I was getting the information on the gig. It said doors open 6:30, comedy show 9:30.
What?
So it's a beefsteak also.
Okay.
So what that means is endless amounts of beer. Okay. Mm-hmm. For 3 hours, 2.5 hours.
Firemen are not known for drinking, right?
No. Now, I've done a couple cop things, and I don't enjoy them at all. But I did a fireman one a couple weeks ago, and it was good. And usually they seem a little bit more fun. A lot of I got the job from the Table 42 shows, who were a lot of the more the firemen who recommended it.
Mm-hmm.
But I get there, and I'm already like, oh, boy, this is going to be rowdy. Like, this is going to be rowdy. And I'm hosting, so I know, and I purposely put myself hosting. I'm going to take the bullet for everyone else and let them shine, you know?
Yeah.
So, shows starts. We start about 9:35, okay? Room is packed, 300-something people. So many people are loaded. So I go up, and I get a weird intro. It's like the fire chief's like, now coming to the stage, there's a Scott Brennan, new comedy, but like it was just like no like, hey, everybody, you ready for the show? You
that's know, up
like,
there with the first Brooke Hollow show.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Hey, everybody, thanks for coming out, and I think a comedy guy's here, so
And when you don't, you just have to quiet the crowd down even for 10 seconds and just be like, hey, you guys ready for comedy? I'm going to turn it over to your host for the night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people don't know that, but still. So right away, I go up. They're just talking everywhere. And I start going into some things. And right away, right in front of the stage are these two drunken assholes. Like, loaded drunk. At one point, I'm starting to open up. And got a couple funny lines. And, you know, playing on the crowd. And
use both of them.
As I'm talking. Yeah, exactly. As I'm talking, the two guys are, like, standing up, and I just stop talking, and I'm, like, looking at them, and people start laughing around them. I'm like, you guys see this right now? And they're like, and all of a sudden, like, they come to, and, like, a minute, they're like, and then the whole, my whole set, like, oh, maybe I'll pop some audio into this later on or something like that. But, you know, like, oh, yeah, high-fiving, standing up and high-fiving each other, like, yeah, like being incredibly racist, like, I'm like, wow, you sir, you are incredibly racist. I'm like, you realize you have 298 people, like, booing you right now? At one point, they start chanting asshole at the two guys, like, and it's just rowdy. And, like, when I realized, I should have never, like, tried to go back at them because it made them part of the show. Like, they thought they were the show. And, like, the people in the back probably, like, we don't even know what's going on. So, I get through it. Eventually, it was okay. I get my laughs. I listened back to it. The night of, I was like, oh, my God, that was the worst set ever. I listened back to it. I'm like, oh, it wasn't that bad. You know, it was better than I imagined. Jackie goes up, and they are awful to her. Like, really mean. Like, just the two of them are just like, ass. And, like, I'm like, oh, my God. And eventually, she gets the crowd on her side by the end, and Joe goes up, and he does better. And he insults them. He eventually shut them down. And I'm sitting there, and like we're talking between comics and talking to Gaffney, and I'm like, oh boy, Gaffney's getting all fired up before he even goes up. And you don't want to get on his. I've seen him like murder a crowd member. Like, I'm picturing.
I just saw the small stuff at Table 42. Yep. And now, people, I've only done this for like 12 years, but what generally happens is the comedian talks.
Yeah. And he's getting all worked up. He's like, I'm not even wearing my button down shirt. Like he had a shirt on a hanger. He's like, I'm just going up in this. And he's getting all worked up. And he got the golden ticket because he went up and the two of those guys left. And then he eventually had a good set. Of course, there's talking. It was a beefsteak, so there's bread tables, which is bread towers, which is great for comedy when there's big things in the way of the comedians. But eventually got through it. But I'm like, oh, I don't know if I would. We'll do this again. Like, I don't know if it's worth it. Like, the money was okay, but it's like a lot of stress. Like, I brought in an extra sound system to make sure it was like loud enough, and just a lot of work, and very like all four comics, very tense, and very like, oh man, this is like you really felt like you had to work. Gaffney had a great set. Joe had a good set. Jackie, she got hammered with me. Me and her took some bullets that night. Like, they didn't even care until like halfway through the show, and then they started listening. So going into the future, I would do a shorter show. I'd probably do a 2, if not 3-man show, make an hour and get up, get out, you know, make it quick. Cause they've been drinking for 3 hours, like drunk guys. Like, listen, when you're at a comedy show, like a couple beers is what you want in people, like fun. Yeah.
there's
loose.
The tipping point is so drastic. It's like, okay, now it's like you're the show. So it was a rough night. But then the next night we had the Brook Hollow show, which was great. We got there. The tables were set up in a way that was like, this isn't going to work. Like, it was like half the audience's back were to the stage. I'm like, So they were going horizontally, basically.
Okay.
So, like, if this is the stage, there'd be like three big horizontal, and then there was one. I'm like,
you got that right, podcast audience?
I'm like, oh boy, this is going to be a problem. Mm. I'm like, we got to get these people turned around. I'm like, it doesn't work. Or I really wanted the rows to go vertically.
Long way, yeah, like the first show.
Okay. But eventually, we had them turn around, but they were, the first row was like, if I came this close, this was basically where they were.
Oh, okay.
Like this, which is kind of, it's just good normally if there's a table, but when they're just like,
yeah.
Oh, like I went up there, I'm like, sir, we are Sandusky close right now. This is going to get strange. But overall, awesome show. Jackie, I let Jackie host it. She did great. I did fine. Not my best, not my worst. KP went up, did really well. And Mike Gaffney, I'm not saying this just because we're using their recorder, but murder. It was just like Larry, because they were talkative. There was a crowd, a couple people talkative in the front, and just lacing into him. And, but the way he was doing, he did this thing like, yeah, like he was at like 40 minutes and we thought he was done. He was like, yeah. He's like, all right. He's like, this is a good show. This is a fun show. He's like, you know, for the next time, I'm going to give you guys some homework. Because he's like, I'm not coming back. Like he was joking. He's like, I ain't coming. I won't do this thing again. And they're all laughing and stuff like that. But he's like, here's some notes. He's like, go to a comedy club. Maybe not as a group. Maybe as a group. And he's like, take notepads with you if you want. He's like, notice what the other people are doing at the comedy club. He's like, step one, they're not talking during the show. Like, they're not talking in the before. And he's like, step two, he's like, everything the comedian says, they're not saying their point after every joke. And he's like, you know, observe the people, because you guys, I can tell none of you have been to a comedy show before. And the way he was doing, he was ripping them to shreds, but like they were with him the whole time. So he gets to like 40 minutes and we think he gets off the stage because he did his like goodnight thing. And he goes right after, he's like, I'm going, I got a couple more things to get to. The guy went for like an hour and 10 minutes just murder. Like, it was awesome. But he did this. KP Burke went on beforehand and KP blew the light so bad. Like, I didn't care. Maybe he was doing well, so I don't really care.
Yeah.
But KP Burke's like, yeah, I'm going to close out now, like, blah, and do like, he did like two more jokes. So Gaffney does it. He's like, yeah, I got a couple more things before I go. And he hears KP laugh and he's like, the hell are you laughing at, KP? He's like, you just blew the light so bad. You did the exact same thing. He's like, look at you. He's like, look at you. He's like, freaking goddamn gym teacher looking, you know? And he's like, and then he's like, KP does the same thing. He's like, he's like my son. He's not all that. He's like, you know what? He might be my son. He doesn't know his mother and father, like, because KP's adopted. And the crowd, I lost it. He was like calling him out right on stage. It was hilarious. But overall, very good show. And I think it'll work there. The time between was nice and short, like dinner and show was nice. Even they finished their food so fast, they started raffling off things from the back. Like, we were finding like ketchup bottles and rolls of toilet paper, and we did like mystery prizes, and like people were getting into, because they ate in like 15 minutes, and there was like an hour and a half before it was like seven. But so I hope it's a good find. So thanks for that, and we'll see what happens in the future. But it was a good first show. Good first show. But so I don't know if you want to get into your Disney trip after the guests, because we got two. Or
We can do after. We can do after.
All right. But a few months ago, it's been a while now.
Basically, it's been the year anniversary of when we talked to him, because it was President's Day last year.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, basically a year ago. I thought it'd be interesting to get his take on some of the things that are going on now, and also some of the things he's actually doing, and that is Mr. Zoltan Istvan. Member of the Transhumanist Party. So let's check in with an old guest. It was one of our favorite episodes. So here we go.
Hello.
Hey, is this Zoltan Istvan?
It is Zoltan Istvan. How are you doing?
How's it going? It's Scott and Mike again from the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. How's it going, buddy?
Yeah, I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing great. Hanging in there.
Living the dream.
Yeah, exactly. Living the American dream. One podcast at a time. But Zoltan, it was Mike just mentioned it was about a year ago to the day almost that we talked to you. We talked to you right around last President's Day. So you have a lot of things going on. Obviously,
first question: did you win?
I did not win. Unfortunately, I was pretty close, but no, I didn't win. I didn't win the election, but. The campaign, the Transhumanist Party presidential campaign went very well, and we really got a lot of people thinking about science and technology. So in that sense, it was definitely a win.
And that was really the goal, right? You know, the realistic goal was to get awareness out there and, you know, kind of get to me, it seems like you were trying to get the name even of the party out there.
Yeah, no. The goal this time around certainly was just to get the name out there. To do well, to get people thinking about science, you know, and just to try to drum up support for the fact that, you know, science can make us one day so we may not have to die. You know, we can actually overcome aging. And in that sense, it worked really well. And yeah, definitely a win. But, you know, in terms of voting, I really got very few votes. I wasn't on any state ballots. We were only able to be voted for in 11 states. So, but we weren't going for that. We were just going for media exposure and kind of having a good time.
Yeah, and then, well, one of those votes was for me. I was here, I wrote you in here in Jersey. Did you get an actual total of how many votes you get?
You know, I haven't gotten a total yet. I know I got 14th place in New York. Mm-hmm. I think I got 18th place in Florida, but unfortunately, I don't have totals. They've been pretty difficult to come by. But the numbers at the very last day, I actually. Recognizing that the country was, really having kind of sort of a split, I decided to say, you know, vote for who you wanted. And if you want to vote for me, please do. I voted for myself.
Right.
But at the same time, all my supporters, I emphasize that this is a vote for your country. And you know I'm not going to win, so you don't need to waste it on me.
Now, let's talk about a little bit about what's going on and what happened. Obviously, President Trump won, if you didn't hear. You know, it seems like every day we're amidst some kind of controversy or some kind of anger. What was your reaction when Donald Trump won?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I was really a supporter of who I would have wanted to win was probably Gary Johnson. You know,
right.
Socially liberal, uh-huh. And yet the House has some fiscal. And you know, for your listeners to know, I interviewed with him about 5 months before the election to be his vice presidential candidate.
Oh, really?
Governor Bill Weld got that. So, yeah, I flew over to New Mexico and spent about 24 hours with Gary Johnson. So he would have been my pick. And, you know, but I, unlike a lot of people, I neither hate Trump
right.
nor did I really, like, adore Hillary. You know, frankly, I think Trump's hitting a bunch of speed bumps. I actually like immigrants, so I'm a little disappointed about that. But that said, the stock market's doing well. So,
right.
Well, you know, we have to be careful of the media. The media,
of course.
One thing I can tell you for sure is, Trump has reignited how well media is doing financially. He's doing better for CNN than CNN would have ever done with Hillary,
mm-hmm.
even if they hate each other. So that's really something to consider when you hear all the noise about all the anger and this and that. Just remember that CNN is doing financially better than it's been doing a long time. And I'm not. This is not to promote Trump in any way or anything else. It's just to, as a journalist to say, look, it's a different ball game, and we're all kind of going down this journey together to
yep.
exploring it.
Now, let me ask you something. On the opposite side, could someone like Donald Trump, you know, because he, you know, ran on a big I'm not a politician, anti-establishment, whether he is or not, a lot of people that brought a lot of people onto his side. A lot of people got behind that. In a way, could that be good for you and the transhumanists, like a, you know, smaller niche kind of party where people are more open to different parties, third parties, fourth parties in the future? Because it seemed to awaken a lot of people. There was a lot of people talking about Bernie running as independent and Trump wasn't really a Republican. You think in some ways it could have some positives for you?
Yeah, no. Well, it's definitely been positive. I mean, Trump was part of the reason that I got so much recognition as basically an independent power candidate with a very small political party. And the fact that many independent candidates got recognition, he made it so that
the presidential campaign became a reality TV show. And, of course, he was very entertaining, but so were people like myself driving a big coffin around the country, you know, trying to talk to people about transhumanism. I think, though, you know, one of the reasons I'm running as a libertarian for governor now in California is because it could set me up for a presidential nomination of the Libertarian Party in 2020. And I think, you know, if Trump doesn't do well, there's going to be a lot of appetite for change in this country. There already was an appetite, but I mean real appetite, like maybe somebody can come in and really just, you know, throw everything down and say, yeah, I know Trump's trying to do that, but honestly, his cabinet was filled with billionaires. It was not exactly the swamp
right.
draining that
no
a lot
draining.
Of we're hoping. You know, I'm not a super rich guy, but I have no idea what a billionaire even thinks. So I can only imagine that they're really out of touch with the general populace. And I feel like we need somebody even beyond like what Hillary, you know, she was sort of out of touch. We need, you know, I like Barack because I felt like he was just a normal guy mm-hmm. who did well. And all of a sudden you could talk to him and he felt for the country. And I'm not saying I'm supporting his policies, but I liked him as a person.
Right.
And I think somebody else could come in and do something similar and just be a normal person. And that would be the guy or the gal to cause that change that we're all looking for.
I agree, man. I think, like I said, I think regardless of what you think of Trump, both seeing Trump, his campaign and Bernie's campaign throughout the whole election process, there's definitely waves being made and there's definitely opening up finally for some, you know, alternate takes and some different parties and whatnot. So I think I don't think you're far off at all by saying that.
Well, good. Yeah. And I mean, I was definitely a Bernie supporter. I just yep. loved what Bernie was doing from a character point of view. Bernie was like a complete hero.
I know.
So, you know, me we'll too. See if he can remain young enough to pull it together here in 3 or 4 years. I'm not saying I would support him. What I'm just saying is, I'm really thankful that the human race has people like Bernie
yes.
that are doing what they do.
Now, Zoltan, let's talk a little bit, because people may have not heard our last episode, and they may not know a lot about you. You mentioned driving a casket around, and you also mentioned getting awareness for the transhumanist movement. So can you explain what you were doing and also kind of what you are standing for?
Yeah, absolutely. So transhumanism just means going beyond the human being using science and technology. It's a social movement that's growing really, really quickly. And a couple million people now definitely around the world that support it would consider themselves transhumanists. And they want to use radical science and technology to change their lives. And this could be anything from a disabled person getting out of a wheelchair because of exoskeleton technology. It could be anything from brainwave technologies that, you know, fighter pilots use. It can be driverless cars. It can be the chip I have in my hand that opens my front door. But transhumanism is just using radical science to go beyond what it means to be a human being. And one of the most important goals of transhumanism is to try to overcome aging with science. And I was trying to spread this awareness. You know, we live in a very Christian nation.
Right.
About 75% of people consider themselves Christian. They believe in an afterlife. They're not worried about too much about dying. Well, people like myself would like to avoid death if we can through science and technology. So I bought a 40-foot bus, 38 feet to be exact, and we transformed it into a big, giant coffin or a casket, painted it all brown, and we drove it across the country. We called it the Immortality Bus. And for 4 months, we went all around the country campaigning and giving rallies and talking to people about what we were trying to do. What we're trying to do is drum up government support, including to put money towards the scientists and the technologists that need it to make us live longer. You can live longer through bionic organs, through 3D printed organs, through stem cell technology, through different types of, even blood transfusions Peter Thiel is doing now. There's a lot of different ways that you can live 20, 30, 100 years longer, they believe, but there's very little funding going to it. So the coffin bus was designed to attract attention so that maybe the government might give more funding to this field.
Now, where is the coffin bus? After you're done with the tour, what do you do with the coffin bus? Mike's looking for a new car.
Yeah. I'm married, so I was thinking, you know, too bad I'm married now, because if I was single, I'd be going out on dates. I think it'd be great to pick up, you know, to go out and just see what they think. But no.
You might get some interesting dates there.
Joking aside,
you got to figure if he's running for governor in California, they have those Hollywood tours. That'd be perfect for that
kind
of stuff.
That's true.
Yeah.
You get like 38 people at a time in that thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we had huge, you know, we had an open invitation to anyone in America to drive with us. And because we were 4 months on the road, we actually picked up a lot of people. Our main goal, just so you know, was to leave from San Francisco and to drive to Washington, D.C., where I posted a transhumanist bill of rights to the U.S. Capitol building.
Really?
And so the bus is now near in D.C., and we posted this transhumanist bill of rights. And, you know, the bill of rights basically says you have a right to do with your body whatever you want. If you want to live longer, to be honest, right now, there's many laws that make it so you actually can't try to live longer. You can't genetically modify your body. You can't try to clone organs. You can't kind of do some of these things because there's a lot of, frankly, Judeo-Christian laws in place that make it so that you really can't radically modify the human body. And the Transhumanist Bill of Rights was trying to change that. And I guess foremostly, declare that aging as a disease as opposed to aging as just a natural phenomenon. But the bus was a great way to pick up people and talk to them. And, of course, TV crews were with us. The New York Times 2 weekends ago ran a 5-page spread on the mortality bus. So, you know, it was a media kind of gain. You know, everywhere we went, people would stop and take photos. And we'd shake hands and hand out pamphlets. You know, we went to the largest the largest mega church in Alabama. And of course, we're sort of a secular group, and that created a lot of news. We were escorted out at gunpoint, and it was, you know, everywhere we went, we were kind of provocative, but trying to spread our message. So sometimes it went well and sometimes it didn't.
It's funny. That's actually that spread in the New York Times was where I thought about, oh, I should contact Zoltan again, like to, you know, follow up on where he's at. I actually saw the, you know, the article about the bus. So there you go.
But I'm not actually driving the bus anymore. What we're trying to do actually is there's a couple documentaries and even feature film people, Hollywood people are interested in making the bus into kind of a comedy philosophical road trip. But what we're trying to do now is donate the bus to a major museum like the Smithsonian that would then put it on exhibit. And then it could permanently be an exhibit, but because it was breaking down, and part of the trip was, you know, it was a 40-year-old bus; it barely could drive, and half the time we were, you know, spewing oil all over the place, trying to fix it. So it was a kind of a classic road trip. We had a robot on board. We were getting chip implants put on board. We had drones on board, virtual reality on board, all sorts of fun things.
So sounds like my trip to Epcot.
I just said the mortality bus broke down. The immortality bus broke down. That's a punchline in itself right there.
Yeah, well, everybody was afraid of dying on it because it was so old and the brakes didn't really work well. And, you know, they were just like, all the poor journalists that came on board, they're like, the irony dying in the immortality bus.
So now that the campaign's over and you're looking forward to running for governor, let me ask you, what is your goal right now heading into it? Is it opening up markets in California? Is it to bring business there? I mean, now with the stock market up, are we seeing new stuff coming through with the transhumanists?
Well, I think so. I think one of the biggest reasons I'm running is because one of the very best chances that transhumanists or that humanity has to overcome aging, to overcome cancer, to overcome heart disease is through this brand new type of technology called genetic editing, a CRISPR-9 technology where you actually go in and alter the genes to be more favorable. The problem, though, is that most of the U.S. Congress, very conservative Republicans, are very afraid of this technology because, in truth, this technology is so radical that you could grow a third arm or you could grow a tail or you could grow a second heart. So if you can literally remake what the human being is because of this technology. And so the Chinese are already beginning to experiment with augmenting intelligence to try to make it so that the new babies actually can be 15, 20, 30, 40% smarter IQ level because of genetic engineering. But of course, as you can see, that's going to be very thorny for a bunch of for the Republican Congress that is sort of like already afraid of abortion rights and things like that.
Right.
Talk about abortion rights. Now we're talking about you know, growing brand new babies in a test tube that are going to be super intelligent. I mean, we really have crossed into the transhumanist era with genetic editing. And one of the things I want to do is make California the world leader in genetic editing, because it could potentially be the very first multi-trillion dollar business. You can literally eradicate cancer through it. They already are treating some types of cancers, and they already are enlarging, you know, muscle masses on animals and things like that. So we could all make ourselves look sort of like these superhumans through this type of technology. But of course, naturally, the technology is hitting a lot of resistance. So in California, one of my main, you know, one of the libertarian goals would be let the technology open to the market. Let people experiment with it. Let them see if it can make our lives better.
You know, I've been in the market for a tail, so I hope that goes.
You look cute with that.
I know. I'm thinking like a lion tail.
Mm.
But, you know, but it is crazy. It is crazy what you're saying. And it you do get pushback all over the place. And it's amazing to me that with elections, we are still talking about, you know, women's right to choose and, like you said, abortion and things like that. And they're controlling elections. And you have a party like you that knows it's possible to eradicate cancer and get and alter things. It's amazing to me that the country's so divided on something like that still, when you could see the benefits of it right in front of you.
It's amazing. You know, I was just doing an interview earlier today, and we were talking about, for example, driverless cars. There's a very good chance within 4 years, we're talking about Trump will still be in office in his first term, that driverless cars could replace up to 4 to 7 million drivers that make their living off driving. Now, that loss of 7 million jobs could be more than loss of jobs than the Great Recession itself about a decade ago. And nobody is talking about how this is going to end up economically. This is the most important economic question of our time. Trump is talking about jobs, not realizing that we're talking like 10% of the jobs are going to be gone just through driverless technology. What about all the other technologies that are coming down the pipeline? So, I mean, the real question with transhumanism is, can this benefit the human race? And if so, you know, what also is the future of the human race if none of us are working because AI or robots do all these things? There's a multitude of questions. And, of course, I don't have all the answers, and neither does the Transhumanist Party, and certainly doesn't the Libertarian Party. But what's most important is asking these questions. And it was astonishing to me during the 2016 debates between Trump and Clinton that none of these questions came up, none of these essentially urgent questions.
Pretty much nothing about the environment, nothing about technology ever came up. It's funny you just said that. I was just listening. I think it was Rogan's podcast. I'm not sure whose it was, but they were just talking about the jobs, the driverless cars, just the amount of truck drivers that would be put out of work, which is a huge part of the working class, just truck driving. So it's like, I can't imagine how they replace that or where those jobs go. What market opens up for new jobs?
And let's, you know, the truck driving is a great concept. There's about 4 million of them, 4 million truck drivers in America. The big thing about truck drivers is a pretty common denominator. They're almost all male.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally between 40 and 60 years old. Mm. They all bear arms. They almost all carry guns or have shotguns. And they're very prideful, tough guys. What do you do when you unemploy 4 million tough guys and then say to them, I'm sorry, but there's nothing to retrain you for? These are people that will cause a revolution. We need, and this is what I, you know, one of the things that's really bothered me about the Republican Congress saying, oh, don't worry, we're going to create all these jobs. Actually, you're not. Technology is not, that's not the way this goes. Yes, you might create new white collar jobs for engineers and stuff like that, but not on the magnitude that's going to be lost. So what do we do with these really good, you know, wholesome Americans that have been driving trucks for 20 years that also bear arms? Well, they're going to be pissed, and we're going to either have to give them free money or give them some type of new lifestyle, but it's not going to be an easy transition. And not talking about it, that helps even less. So I'm worried. Like the truck driving community, you know, on the road, I was talking to these people in my coffin bus. I met them. They were great people. But
that sentence throws this conversation off. I was talking to them in my coffin bus, and
so I became friends with many of them, and they just, you know, they had no idea what was going to happen when all of a sudden driverless trucks. Of course, there's a number of companies in Silicon Valley as well as anywhere other place in America working on driverless trucks. I mean, it's a $100 billion business. I mean, it's going to be huge.
But with all this movement going on, who could you say, along with you with this movement, is like the newest up-and-comer that we should be looking forward to talking about transhumanism and the party?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I think the gentleman that I handed the Transhumanist Party off to is a very interesting character. His name's Gennady Stolaros, and I don't know if I can even pronounce his last name right. But, you know, he's done a lot. You know, a lot of people – the thing with the Transhumanist Party with me is I was so busy with the campaign, I really couldn't do much as its chairman to grow it. Right. But he's been doing quite a bit in growing first off, they redid the Transhumanist Bill of Rights. Much more explicit. I thought a lot better, actually. They did a great job. They're creating all these different parameters, all these new types of positions, so and creating state parties. So I think he's a good person to talk to. And also his wife is also an avid transhumanist, and they're a good couple together because they, you know, it was a big choice who I handed the party off to. It wasn't right for me to continue it. It needed new leadership, new blood. And I felt like they've done a really good job in continuing it. And I think they'd have a lot of interesting things to say.
So I guess we're coming close to the end here. I know you have a time restraint. So you're running for governor. When is that in the process right now? Or like when is governor up in California?
Sure. So governor, you know, is up in California typically in November 2018. But in February, what happens is all the people actually running start filing their paperwork. And then in the end, because of California regulations, only two people will end up and be in the final kind of pick. So I think sometime in May or something, they make that final pick.
So it's coming soon.
Yes, it's coming soon. But people are declaring now, beginning their campaign, getting their support base, starting their rallies. I'm sort of in that stage right now where I'm putting together my team, starting to, you know, sign up for rallies and trying to get people to set, you know, get some stages together where I can go and speak. And, you know, I'm new to the Libertarian Party, and people are, of course, naturally skeptical that, okay, here comes this science candidate. Yes, he's written a libertarian novel. My novel, The Transhumanist Wager, was quite well known as a libertarian book, but at the same time, it's you know, because I ran for the Transhumanist Party, there's still some hesitation. And yet at the same time, libertarians are some of the best transhumanists out there. The transhumanist movement was actually started by a bunch of libertarian philosophers, so it's not that big of a crossover. But one of the main things I'm trying to do in the next month or two is win over the libertarians that already exist and show them that I can be true to their party and to their ideals while still putting forth a very strong science candidacy.
One other question I have is we're looking for resources to help us grow and live longer and so forth. In the next few years, I know they're trying to bring people up to Mars and live off of there. Can you see us gaining any kind of technology or whatever from these excavations to new planets and so forth?
You know, what happens oftentimes is NASA has been responsible for a lot of great technology. Some of solar panels and that type of technology originally came from NASA. So did GPS. So did a bunch of other different types of interesting things, the stuff in your refrigerator that you use. So whenever you do giant missions like that, it's not that like they made these things and they all of a sudden are going to hit the populace. It's more that like someone says, oh, wow, remember that thing we used on that spaceship? That would be great for this everyday use. And then that's how it hits the field. That's one way that I think these manned missions to Mars are great. I think more importantly, though, is really the psychological angle. You know, one of the great reasons America became America is because we won the space race against the Russians. And that was that's something that united us nationally. I mean, open the news. We are one of the most divided nations in the world right now. It seems like we're just at each other's necks.
Yep.
A good, solid, ambitious, transhumanist ambition, overcome aging, a moonshot to get to Mars, something like this. These are things that bring the country together. And these are things that I would, you know, if I was in government as the president, I would really focus on, and as well as the private industry, because psychologically, this is something that can really do well for America and make us say, you know, we have a lot more in common than we actually have otherwise. And hey, in the end, we're still all Americans, and this is a great country to be in. So I very much support those kind of missions to Mars and a lot of the space industry, even if it's not the most practical thing right now.
Zoltan, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on, and we wish you the best of luck with the governor race, and we hope you stay in the headlines, stay in the news, because I think what you're doing is very important. I just have one question, kind of outside of all of this. When you think of, like, either books or movies that have to do with either AI or the future, whether it be like 1984 or something like that, is there like a book or a movie that inspired you to think like that, or one that you find that's very relevant even today, with that kind of theme that's realistic?
You know, the movies that have inspired me, there have been many, are just the typical ones. I got to be honest, one of the most interesting philosophical dilemmas that's happened in the last 2 years is this idea that The Matrix is much more than just a movie. The Matrix has a very strong philosophical basis of being a real situation,
yep,
where we actually are living in a kind of philosophical, you know, pluralistic universe, or universe of the hologram. There's been a huge amount of, you know, in fact, the God particle, the discovery of it last year was something that pointed to that whole thing as well. This idea that, wow, maybe there are things happening that make our consciousness more than just we're animals with a bunch of flesh that evolved through the eons. Maybe we are actually part of a much bigger system, and we are being observed, or we are being manipulated. And so The Matrix, I have watched The Matrix about 30 times in the last 5 years. I mean, more than anything else by a long shot. So if anyone's interested, take a look at The Matrix, and don't just see it as a sci-fi movie. See it as a philosophical journey, and try to understand that there are real physicists and real philosophers out there, some of the best universities in the world, that are coming around to this idea that we very much could be living in some type of holographic universe. And it doesn't mean anything changes. It just gives you a broader perspective on these things, like even what I'm talking about with transhumanism and stopping aging. I mean, the whole thing is pretty bizarre, but there's been a lot of science to prove some of this stuff recently.
My more important follow-up question is, you saw The Matrix 30 times. How many times could you stomach the other two sequels?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, not as many times, of course, but still many times.
Yeah.
I wish you would just admit, like everyone else, you love it because you want to learn kung fu like that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really care about the other stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Zoltan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes, and we'd love to check in maybe another year from now and see where you're at.
Absolutely, absolutely. I would love that. Maybe when I'm governor.
Absolutely.
We could be the official podcast of California.
Yeah, yeah. Bring us on over. Yeah. We'll do your pressers. We'll be like your Sean Spicers.
Of course. Well, hey, but thank you so much for having me on. It's been great talking to you guys again.
Absolutely. And real quick, where do people go to check out your, what's the best way to either communicate, or best way to either check out your message and just happenings of Zoltan? Happenings of Zoltan. That's a great name for a website.
the best way is just to go to ZoltanEastvan.com. But, you know, I've written like 200 articles in the last 3 years. So just, you can also Google Zoltan and transhumanism, and it'll give you all up. And of course, I'm on Twitter and Facebook and all those other things. But my main website, Zoltan Istvan, has most of my, a lot of videos and stuff like that where people can discover lots of fun things.
Zoltan, thanks so much, and good luck, okay?
All right, thanks, you guys. You have a great day.
You too, man.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, Zoltan Istvan.
Educational and fun.
You should be his marketing man. Educational and fun.
What else can you Zoltan tell about
Zoltan for
him?
Everyone.
Not that much.
Vote, vote, vote. Yeah, he's just a super interesting guy. That guy's going to go places, man. I'm telling you. We're going to look back on these podcasts and be like, we interviewed like a vice president one day, or he's going to have something in the cabinet somewhere one day.
I can definitely see it. I mean, it's just a matter of time. It's just, for lack of a better term, it's getting past the naysayers in life.
Well, it's true. Like, when I was talking to him about, like, I think, if anything, Trump can really help inspire that next, like, super progressive, complete opposite of Trump, educated, smart, well-thought-out guy that's going to capture the whole nation, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe we weren't ready yet, but that next, I feel like after this guy,
was the practice swing.
After this guy, I feel like maybe people go, okay, we got to get this one right.
All right. We had some good ingredients in the pot, but we have to add a few more things to make this edible.
Yeah, like maybe like the real actual educated, like anti-establishment guy, you know, being bought out kind of guy, but not this guy. But we got to switch gears because we are going to step right back into another interview.
Ooh.
Berlo, you love diving.
Yeah.
You know, I know you are very into diving. I'm sure in
Disney. I got the body for it. Both know that.
I'm sure in Disney you did plenty of diving.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing about the Disney trip was picking out Speedo for the diving down there.
Did you go with, like, the Mickey Mouse ears on the Speedo to really...
You know, I changed it up. It was a chip from Chippendale I used.
But a couple weeks ago, we talked to Kirby Chambliss from Red Bull Air Racing. Now we're going to be talking to Stephen LeBoux, who sounds like an artist, LeBoux. But he is a Red Bull cliff diver.
Ooh.
Okay. So pretty cool. If you look at these videos, they are absolutely... Shut up, Obi.
Obi's sharing his thoughts on cliff diving.
They are absolutely frightening how high these guys dive from. It's like you see diving in the Olympics, and then you see this this diving. It's insane. So we're going to call Steven right now. And get him. Steve, it's Scott from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing?
Doing well, Scott. Thanks.
All right, is this a good time, or you need a few minutes? You sound quiet.
Nope, all good.
Oh, okay. Are you on a speakerphone or something? Or?
No, I actually have my headphones in. I'm getting ready to take them out just now. I had to run upstairs.
Oh, no problem.
He had to dive off the roof, so that's practice.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, no, you sound a million times better.
The deep end. Much better. Right on.
Way better. Steven, fellow Jerseyite, you said, right? You said you grew up in Jersey? Where are you from?
I grew up in Ewing, New Jersey.
Oh, okay, right by TCNJ, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's where I started diving, actually.
Really?
Fun story.
College in New Jersey?
Yeah.
That's where I have my
It was Trenton State College at that time.
Steve, I was just saying... you see diving on, we'll get into the whole thing, but you see diving on the Olympics and whatnot, and you go, holy crap, that's high. You see these Red Bull diving videos, like, they give me, like, chills. Like, it's pretty, you do a pretty intense thing here, pal.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel about it, too. Every time, honestly, it's it doesn't get any less scary, like, even doing it. You know what I mean? Even doing it for a period of time, you're kind of still battling nerves all the time, so it's definitely intense.
Yeah. So take us to the beginning, okay? Were you a diver or a diver or a swimmer growing up? When did you actually take diving, seriously?
So yeah, I guess honestly, I started in the like learn to swim programs. I think I had tried like some other sports, just like baseball. All my friends were doing that or whatever. Hated it. Didn't like any like soccer or anything like that. Just not a fan. And so I was doing the learn to swim program, and at the end they let you jump off the diving boards. Favorite part, right there. And so
early on.
I mean, at a very young age, at 7 years old. I mean, I saw it and went, that's what I want to do.
So were you diving competitively at an early age, or when does that actually start? I don't know much about diving. As far as youth diving, did you start in high school, middle school, elementary school?
No, I mean, so I started at 7 years old. The thing was, like, I was doing the learn to swim program, and at the end they let you jump off the boards, and I went up to the 3 meter, like the high board,
right
at that pool, and I tried to do a front flip, and I landed flat on my face.
Oh,
and
I had the same story.
But
almost.
I mean, at 7 years old, you're like, whatever.
Yeah, you cry it off.
You don't really know any better. And actually, the thing was that the diving coach at the college was there when I did that because they were getting ready to start their practice, and she went up to my dad and was like, "Hey, maybe he's got a future in diving." And
wow.
So yeah, I mean, from there, I started diving competitively at the age of seven. Jeez. You know, real basic stuff, obviously, just jumps and like basic dives and things like that. Wow. At that age, obviously. But
now,
yeah,
now do you think it's because she saw like an element of like no fear? Was that like, is that the first like initial thing you need? You think like, you know, because obviously your dive probably wasn't perfect the first time you went on. Was she just like, wow, that kid just went off the 3 meter with no problem?
Right. And I think that's probably part of it. You know what I mean? Like when you, if you can identify that from an early age, I think that's probably, you know, where it started. Cause like you said, it's not perfect by any means. Landed flat on my face. But you know, someone that's willing to do that and then kind of get out and laugh it off and go up and, you know, do something else. That's kind of half the battle as far as diving goes, like having that mental ability to kind of get up after you did something that definitely sucks and do it again.
I remember I was probably like maybe 13, something like that. We were down in Wildwood where they still, all the hotel, like not all of them, but a lot of hotels still had high dives.
Yeah.
Which now you, they're like,
right, right.
They're like a thing of the complete past at this point. They're like rare. They're like unicorns at this point. Because
it's an insurance nightmare.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I go up. I was like a water rat. Like I was always in the pool and jumping in and doing stupid things and flips and front flips. And I go on the high dive and I go to do a front flip and I don't get anywhere near complete. Or I lay flat on my back, like just solid thump. And like I remember not being able to breathe for it would seem like eternity at the time. And that, I think I had your no fear thing until that happened, and then that was the end of my high dive career.
Yeah, I mean, fear is definitely learned. You know what I mean? Like I said, at that age, you kind of do something stupid, and you go, well, that sucked. I better not do that again.
Yep.
But, I mean, and that's kind of the cool thing. Like, you just, you know, kind of had a little story there, and that's kind of the cool thing of, like, what we do. You know, even if not everyone can picture it or something, like everyone can kind of relate to, like they have a story from the high dive or like jumping off of something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it, I think, I mean, sort of a universal thing. Mm.
Soon kids will have to put on those virtual reality things to even know what a high dive is. But
well, we'll run out of water beforehand, so we won't have to worry about that. So what kind of training or exercise do you have to do when you start working out when you're 7 or 8? Because obviously it takes a lot to get your body in the air to begin those flips.
Yeah, I guess at that age, you're sort of just learning the positions. You know, there's three positions. There's straight, tuck, pike. And one of the biggest things is, I guess you have to kind of be comfortable landing on your head. You know what I mean? That's diving, essentially. You're diving in on hands first. So a lot of the things you do from a very early age are just learning how to enter the water properly, learning the different positions. And then, yeah, really just going through the routines of a diver, you know, all the exercises that come along with diving, all the drills, things like that. And then, you know, kind of introduction to competition, doing very, very basic stuff, but just being introduced to the idea of competition. And, so it starts very, very slowly. And then, you know, depending on how you progress, and it's a very individual sport. So, you know, depending on how you progress is what you learn next.
Now, you said something there, and I don't want to forget it. The whole landing on the head thing. Now, with the way sports are now, like I coach high school soccer, everything's about concussion. Has that entered the diving world all of a sudden to be, you know, hitting the water's got to be just as bad, you know, or if not worse, I guess, from heights.
Right. I mean, it really has come to the forefront, I think. Concussion training, concussion protocols. Diving, it's, you know, from that high, you're not really going to get a concussion.
Right.
I think once you start talking about 10-meter platform, like the highest platform you would see in the Olympics,
right,
then, you know, you can really start kind of going, okay, this is really kind of getting dangerous. And, you know, I think it's probably there's a lot fewer concussions in diving than there are in a sport like soccer, say, or anything
where there
could be sort of incidental contact. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely something you've got to be wary of. Anytime, you know, you're talking about landing on your hands and your head, there's, you know, neck stability, all of that stuff. So
yeah,
all that stuff definitely comes into play, but as you get higher and higher.
Like, literally, I never even thought about that until you just said the idea of, like, landing on your head, and now everything is, like... Like, to a point, I think it's... Sometimes we get over concerned where, like, in a game like soccer, you're taking heading out of the game until 12, 13 years old now. It's, like, a huge part of the game. And, I don't know, you think about in the world, if you're going to train kids to be on the international stage, what is that going to do for... You know, soccer. But my thing was, I don't even know how you could even do diving without being, you know, landing that way. That's what diving is. You know,
I can't think of a helmet.
Well, yeah,
unless you have a can opener competition, or, you know.
But, yeah. So you guys actually touched on a few things just there. Like, first off, in diving, there is no protective equipment. You're in a Speedo, and I mean that's that.
I'm in that right now.
I use a mouth guard now that I'm cliff diving, but I would have never thought of that, you know, during my competitive diving days. You know, with diving too, like a dive, when you say, like, you just think of a dive, of course it's hands first and landing on your head, but there are competitive dives in the sport of diving, like as you're learning where you land on your feet.
Okay.
There's some feet first dives from lower levels and things like that. So there is sort of that buildup, and with, I'm sure, any sport, there's kind of built-in safety protocols where, like, you know, kids under – you're not allowed to compete 10-meter platform until you're in the age group of 14, 15.
Okay.
You can train it all you want, you know, depending on your coach and your ability level, but you can't compete until 14, 15 from the 10-meter. So, yeah, like you said, there's sort of those built-in protocols. And I guess it just, you know, depends on the level. Like it's like you said, in soccer, if you're really good, yeah, you're going to be out practicing your headers, and you might not be able to use it, you know, for a while, but you're practicing it.
Right. So. Now, Stephen, with all the flips and acrobatics that go into diving, were you a gymnast at all too, or?
Never. And you know what? That's pretty common now. You see a lot of gymnasts that kind of transfer over to diving. It's a little bit safer than gymnastics. The burnout rate's not so high, and kind of a smaller community. There's a lot of gymnasts, but I started purely diving. I mean, like I said, it was something I looked at and went, that's what I want to do.
Now, how long were you diving before you were aware of competitive diving? I mean, the next step, and we'll get into the Red Bull cliff diving.
Well, like I said, I mean, I was doing competitions at age 7, 8. And at that point, you don't think much about it. You're just kind of doing it, and they go, hey, we're going to travel here. And you go, okay, cool. You know, you're just kind of going through the motions. You really start to notice, like, diving is a very small community, and especially, like, the higher level you are, you know what I mean? It's a really small community. So, like, if you go to, like, a national level, you have to go through regionals and go through zones, and then you get to that national level. But, like, you're competing against the same kids. You see the same kids from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to kind of recognize, like, okay, this is, you know, like, I'm competing here. Like, this is what I'm doing. And then, I mean, as far as, like, looking at Red Bull cliff diving or the idea of cliff diving. I guess I didn't even know that was, I didn't know Red Bull cliff diving was a thing until I was, you know, I had graduated college.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really know until I started looking you guys up, like, I don't know, a couple months ago. I didn't know it was full out. Like, I mean, it's all over the world. I mean, when I looked it up, I'm like, oh my God, these guys go to, you know, I can remember South Wales, Australia, a million different places, watching videos from all over the world. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's exciting. And travel is obviously one of the cooler things. It's, you know, and it's growing too. It's crazy because, like, you know, we had some stops in the U.S. and they're becoming, you know, more and more successful. We had a couple really successful stops in Boston, but, like, we'll go to France, for example, and there's 75,000 spectators.
Really?
Like, holy crap.
Wow.
This is like being a football player, you know what I mean? Or like it's at that level. And I never thought something like that was possible. So it's really cool to kind of get up there and you're like, dude, I get chills. Like, we're just talking about it. Like, I got the heebie jeebies thinking about it. Like, that, it's awesome. 75,000 people. You think about that. It's insane.
Well, I'm more surprised that there's water that you want to swim in Boston, but still.
Yeah. Well, right into the Boston Harbor, no less.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Now, it says on a, I was reading a bio of you, it says you just missed the Olympic diving team in 2004. Now, was that your goal all along, was to do Olympic diving? And like, when did the transition from the not from the, I guess it's from the 10 meter or whatever it is to this Red Bull diving? Like, when was the transition from, okay, the Olympics are no longer my thing, this Red Bull thing is, and how did you even get involved in it?
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, all growing up, that's the thing. You're like, you know, you watch the Olympics, you're like, I'm going to go to the Olympics. I want to do that. And, you know, I was good enough to get a scholarship to go to college. And then, yeah, I attended Purdue University on like a scholarship for diving.
Nice.
And even then, you know, you're training. But at that point, I realized, like, okay, I'm not Olympic material per se. And, you know, I kind of had that realist thought, like, okay, I'm thankful that, like, I got a scholarship to come to college to do what I love. And I've traveled the country. I'm happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so competing there, you're going, okay, I'm not Olympic material, super happy for everything. But then, you know, I was introduced late high school, early college, especially to this idea of performing diving, like in a theme park for, you know, you go to Six Flags, Great Adventure. They used to have a dive show with a high dive ladder. And that was my first show. Like, I had an assistant coach who was doing that at the time. And he was like, hey, you know, like, come out and try this, like, entertainment side. And that was a whole new world for me where, like, it's, you know, diving's very structurally rigid. It's, you know, everybody quiet while someone dives, you know what I mean? And kind of the idea of entertainment was really exciting for me because it was loose. Like, you could kind of do whatever you want. The crowd doesn't know if you messed up or not, really.
Right.
So that whole idea of not being judged and just, you know, just fully loving what you do really appealed to me. So in college, I started doing these shows in the summer, like for some summer cash or whatever was my job. And I mean, you do all sorts of different things. You dress up as a frog or a pirate or whatever, and you go through this production, the show. And that's where I really kind of saw high diving for the first time. I didn't think much of it. You know what I mean? I was just kind of doing my thing. But towards the end of college, I decided, like, okay, I'm going to go into this entertainment aspect, and like, I need to learn how to high dive. So I went up and kind of did my thing from a little bit lower. I mean, it's like 18 meters or 60 odd feet or 50 something feet. I don't know exactly. And that was sort of my big transition. And after I graduated college, I moved to China like a couple weeks after, and I started doing these shows full time. And that was where I got introduced to my first full height, 27 meter high dive, which is 90 feet. And then, a buddy of mine, like after, like I finished my year in China, and a buddy of mine was like, hey, Red Bull Cliff Diving's having this tryout. Like, I really think you should go. And I kind of, you know, a buddy of mine was doing it at the same time. And I was like, all right, like I'll put in my application or whatever. And I got selected to go out to Australia to compete for like a spot on the world tour. And yeah, that was it there. So
90 feet, what your first dive from 90 feet, is it just like, okay, I'm going to do you just jump off it a few times, or do you actually go out there and dive? Like I can't even comprehend going head first off of that height. Like, what is your thought process and the first time?
That's one of the big things too. The transition from Olympic style diving to high diving.
It's three times the height.
The biggest difference is, yeah, absolutely. And the biggest difference is, you know, you'll notice no one's landing on their hands. It's all feet first entry. So
okay.
I had to kind of, you know, I had this skill set that I've worked tirelessly for since the age of 7. And I kind of had to tweak it a little bit to learn how to land on my feet. But, you know, at the same time, like I worked so hard for this, I'm not ready to give it up. Like, I don't want to stop. And if there's a way to make money doing it, like, for sure, I'm going to just continue doing what I love and try to work it out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make the transition to like learning how to land on your feet, which is probably the biggest step. And then past that, adjusting to that height is it's so hard. It takes repetition. And the only way to get repetition is like just to get out there and experience it. So actually, you know, I was in China and I had done maybe 20 meter, and now here's 27 meter. And I kind of was like, yeah, okay, whatever. It's a high dive. Like, no big difference. And it's a huge difference. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's out of control. And then, so I was doing like pretty simple maneuvers, like two flips with a half twist. It's super basic.
Yeah, I do that right into my bed every night usually.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
He did that a few times like while you were talking. It was amazing.
Like a whole,
you know, the basics.
Whole lifetime for it.
Us divers, yeah. We call them the basics.
Yeah. So funny story is, like, I get invited out to this competition in Australia. I've done a total of, like, two different dives from that height, you know? And they're going, okay, you need four dives. Two have to be like this, and two easy dives and two hard dives, essentially. I'm like, all right, well, I've done the easy dives, no problem. I'd never done, like, multiple, like, applying the idea of Olympic diving to a high dive. You know what I mean? I'm, like, doing these real simple maneuvers. And, yeah, so I was like, oh, no, I just basically faked it. You know what I mean? Because they flew me out to Australia, and I'm like, oh, I can do this, no problem, or whatever. So I get up in front of the whole, like, the whole competition, guys that were, like, trying to requalify, so they had already been high diving, all the judges, all the organizers. And I get up there, and I chuck this dive. It was supposed to be four flips with a half twist. I was like, oh, no problem. And I came out, and I finished the dive, and I still had maybe, like, 11 meters to go. And I just took it and landed on my tailbone, and I actually fractured my tailbone.
Oh,
and,
wow.
This is, like, the first day in front of everybody.
I was going to say, this is early on,
too.
Oh,
yeah.
What did the judges give
you? It was, like, my first really hard dive, and it was just awful.
So, injury has got to be a part of the sport. Like, what is that the worst injury you've suffered doing this, or?
That's, like, the worst. That's the worst, like, one-time injury. There's a lot of chronic injuries, you know what I mean? Like, the adductors and the groin muscles get strained a lot, so it's just really hard to, like, squeeze your feet together.
Uh-huh.
You get a lot of, like, I have chronic lower back pain. You know, I've had it for the past few years, kind of battling through. So there are just a lot of chronic injuries, but that was the worst, like, one time where, like, okay, my leg looks like a piece of marbled meat. It's not a pretty thing to talk about, but when you land on the water like that, it's an enema. So I shit myself in the water. Like, I mean, it's not pretty, but any high diver will tell you, like, if you land wrong, you're going to shit yourself.
Yeah. So. Wow.
What's worse, shitting yourself or the guy who has to go in the water after you?
Yeah. So then we have water safety teams.
Ah, you know, Steve!
They're like, and they're like, luckily it was murky water, so I don't think anyone knew, but, like, yeah, pretty embarrassing point there in my career.
If you eat Mexican the night before, you shoot up like an extra 6 meters.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But I've watched it, like, after I, you know, we got the interview together, I watched, like, probably 10, 15 things on YouTube. And when you guys dive into the water, there's, like, four guys that immediately, like, our safety guys or whatever you want to call them, lifeguards or dive team or something like that, that immediately check you guys out. That, to me, is just a sign of how dangerous this has got to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely dangerous. I think, like, any impact is obviously the most dangerous point, like, into the water. There's people that have been knocked out. There's people that have, you know, broken bones. A guy bruised his lungs and heart, you know. So there's very serious concern there in the water. So those guys are there, and they're sort of our life support right there, you know what I mean? Like, they're there to make sure everything's okay. Like, when you come out of the water, we're instructed to give the okay sign.
Okay.
And if you don't, like, they're gonna backboard you out of protocol. Like, that's their job. Hmm. So, yeah. And you know what? Like, it just goes to show that as dangerous as it is, like, we absolutely put safety first, and Red Bull puts safety first for what we're doing. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's really nice to, like, look down and obviously see those guys there and know that they've been trained and they're ready to go if anything happens.
I've seen some of the shows where there's either a platform or you're literally diving from a cliff. Do you have a preference between the two, and what's the biggest difference in either of those dives?
I mean, I prefer the platform just because that's what I grew up doing. I'm comfortable on a platform. But it is called cliff diving, and part of that is the marketing. Part of that is because we can actually dive from a cliff, you know what I mean, if we have to, if it's you know, but they're checking all that, making sure the height, the depth and everything is all good.
Right.
I just, for me, like, I just feel way more comfortable going off of a platform where, like, I know this structure, whereas, like, a cliff could be maybe your toes are angled down or, like, your feet are uneven, or there's just all these little variables that you have to kind of take into account.
Now, tell us about this Red Bull cliff jumping series. Like, what is it like a season? Is it just events? How is it scored? How do you win it? Give us a little insight to people who don't know the sport.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so the series is very much, it's a world tour, first off. So right. Every stop is scored based on your ranking. Like, first place gets 200 points, second place gets 160 points, and so on down the list. And then at the end of the year, you have your world champion. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot like, I guess, NASCAR would be the best example,
right. All right.
Where they kind of do that. And then each dive is scored very much like Olympic style diving. So you have a scale from 0 to 10 in half point increments. And then the judges are essentially looking at three phases of a dive. The takeoff. Okay. Are you jumping? Is it too far out? Is it too close? You know, they're deducting half points or points for those things if it's too far away, for example. The flight phase. So your air, if you have, you know, if you declare a dive in pike, for example, where your legs are supposed to be straight and you have kind of bent legs, or it's called a crimp, you know what I mean? So your legs are bent. They're deducting all these little points, and it's, you know, essentially their job to kind of watch everything and deduct on the way down. Like, every dive, for example, starts at a 10, and then you kind of have to deduct as you go. And then, of course, the most important thing, what everyone sort of notices, is the entrance into the water.
Right.
Did it make a big splash? Did you not make a splash at all? So judges kind of have to look at that in real time and go, okay, you know, he jumped too far out. Maybe the position was off a little bit here, landed a little bit short of vertical, and then they would kind of give their score.
Do judges get
every
replay?
Every dive you do. Judges do not get replay, which is probably, you know, in this sport, a good thing, because,
right.
you know, perfection on a slow-mo replay is going to be
right.
almost impossible. You know what I mean? So it's kind of just one of those things where they have to look at it, assess it as they go, and throw up their score.
Okay.
And then, so each dive, depending on how difficult it is, has a tariff, like a degree of difficulty. And then they will take, there's five judges, they'll toss out the high score and the low score. They'll add the three middle scores together and then multiply it by, like, the degree of difficulty, so how hard the dive was, and then that's your total score. And you'll do, you know, everyone does three dives. The top eight will do a fourth dive, like, in finals, and then that's your result, essentially.
Have you ever came out of the water and just wanted to scream at some judge and all, busting your rear end on a dive, and they give you something low?
After you busted your rear end into the pool?
there's always, I mean, any time where the judging is subjective, you know what I mean? There's no set formula as to how it works. You're gonna have those feelings where you're like, God, I don't think I deserve that. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you didn't get to see it; you just felt it. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
But there's times when we're watching a dive and you're going, you know, you watch a score and you go, "Come on, like, I think it should have been more than that for this and this reason." But like I said, there's no formula, so it's up to the judge.
I can't even imagine. Like, I read that you did something with five front flips, something ridiculous. but I can't even imagine the judge. Like, it's the same thing when I watch, like, snowboarding and skateboarding or anything like that. Like, when they're doing triple kickflip, I can't count the flips like that quick. Like, it happens so quick. I'm amazed guys can be like, okay, that's a quadruple. Yeah, quadruple flip. Do you have to report the dive that you're going to attempt to do beforehand?
Right. No, and that's a good point too. And I think it comes with, you know, once you're in the sport for so long, or you've seen it for so long, you can pick those details out.
Right.
But yeah, we absolutely have to report dives we're going to do. We have to submit a dive sheet the day before, like saying, hey, these are the dives I'm going to do. Most of them are set, but in the final round, like, we have a rule where you can say, hey, I, you know, based on how well you're doing, like, maybe if you're doing really well and you want to play it safe, like, just kind of, you can change your last dive, or you can go, like, crap, I need a bigger dive to, like, win if I want to win. So we have some flexibility, but for the most part, you know, the judges know exactly what we're doing, and we have to kind of look at the judges and give them the okay signal before we take our dive.
Now, what's it like working with Red Bull? Because we talked to Kirby Chambliss, who does the air racing, and even as I'm going on the site, it seems like they just go out and find the most crazy, exciting sports, and they just put their name on it. So I'm just wondering your thoughts about Red Bull.
Yeah, I mean, and that's pretty much what they do. They are amazing at what they do. I mean, they are a marketing machine, and you have to think too, like, everything they do, they go, okay, this is going to help us sell a can. You know what I mean? That's That's the ultimate goal for them.
Right.
But they're so good at what they do, and they have such a good work model. Like, you know, they hire people that are very passionate about what they're doing, and they encourage people to really think outside of the box. It's not your typical 9-to-5. Like, people that work for Red Bull will tell you, like, it is one of the most challenging and demanding jobs you could ever have. But they all love it. They love what they do. And that's part of what really makes the brand. And for us, obviously, like, we're just fortunate that, like, myself, for example, like, I have this passion, and this is my art, and Red Bull is providing the medium. They're saying, we're giving you a canvas, like, go do your thing. And so for me, on the outside, like, looking in, I think it's awesome. And they really do take care of us. I mean, we have after parties, we have, you know, they fly us out, they put us up, they give us prize money, they feed us. So I can't, it's really hard to complain.
Yeah, man. Take us back to 2015 in France.
Okay.
I'm literally looking at a still of your body. I would call that like a 60-degree angle of your head slapping the platform, and you look like you're 10 million feet in the air, to be honest. There's so many people watching. You mentioned 75,000 people, which I find amazing. But you whack your head, and somehow your body still looks graceful on the way down. Tell us about that. I mean, you type in your name, that's the first thing that pops up on videos, YouTube.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, that went viral, and for good reason. It just shows the danger of the sport, and especially this sport. Like, I mean, anyone can hit their body on the platform or the diving board, but to have to fall 90 feet after that is pretty incredible.
And, ow, splash.
It's more like,
no press is bad press, right? Yeah, I guess, you know, for me, honestly, when I look at that, it's a testament to being like 200% mentally committed to what you're doing, you
right.
know what I mean? And not letting anything sort of stop what you're trying to do. So there are a million ways that could have gone wrong. And, I definitely encountered one of them with my face, and then luckily, you know, I won't even say luckily, cause I don't think it was luck. I really believe that I had put in enough hours training that my body knew what it was meant to do, regardless of anything kind of getting in the way. So, I mean, that's sort of how I look at it. And honestly, like, that sucked. It was a really scary moment.
Yeah.
I had never been backboarded before. I've never done anything like crazy like that. But it really wasn't that bad of an injury. I got lucky in that aspect where
yeah, I was gonna say your post,
the way I contacted the platform, the way I scraped off was all very, you know, a couple millimeters either way. And it could have been way worse. You know what I mean? So I was very fortunate in that aspect. But the scariest part was, we had a competition 2 weeks from that day, and I had to get up and do that dive again. So I had to kind of take a couple days to recover and then kind of go into the pool on the platforms from like 7 meter and go, okay, I need to figure this out because I've got a competition coming up and I'm not going to not do this. You know what I mean? I'm not backing down. So for me, that was sort of the scariest part, was going, okay, I've got to overcome this and get it done.
Yeah. I was going to ask you two questions from that. And you touched on both of them. One was getting back on the board after that, the feelings and the you know, shaking it off. And two, I watch your like post, whatever you want to call it, post dive interviews. And it looks like you got like, you know, punched in the face, not hit a platform at 100 feet in the air or whatever. It's amazing, man.
Yeah. And so super fortunate. Like I said, the way I contacted the platform and the way my body was moving at the time, it was, like I said, just really fortunate. It could have been way, way worse if it was a different dive and I had hit the platform like that. So, like I said, super lucky there. And yeah, at that point too, I mean, my adrenaline was still through the freaking roof. So yeah, the post interview, I was like, yeah, no problem. And I was on the plane home like, what the fuck?
It's amazing you say that, the thing about the training, and I truly believe that. Like, you've probably done so many dives, and it's amazing to think the human body, like, it, you know, through like synapses and muscle memory and training and
and commitment that you're able to complete that dive. And I completely believe it is from that. It's from your body doing it so many times and the concentration. And it's almost like your body took over.
Yeah, no, and I fully agree with that. I'm like I said too, that's what I had programmed my body to do, you know, throughout years of training. And so it's just, I mean, yeah, body took over and that was that.
Now, Stephen, how old are you?
I'm 31.
31. Okay. So you're
about 31 going on 32 in June.
Okay. So you're basically my age. What is the longevity for a diver? What is the average age for a diver? The average career? I mean, I guess you can't even say with this sport since it's relatively new, but like, what is the guys you're with? Are you on the old side? Are you right in your prime? Like, what is it?
I think 31 is about the average age, actually.
Okay.
And yeah, it's a good question too, because it's sort of a fluid question as well, because when the guys first started competing, the height wasn't at 27 meters. You know what I mean? They were kind of at 20, 21 meters, 22 meters. And they were sort of adjusting. And, so I think, you know, we have a guy now, Orlando Duque, who is like the face of the sport, the guy who brought
El Duque, the pitcher from the Yankees.
Oh, wow.
He's diving now.
He's versatile.
Yeah. So yeah, sort of like this guy, he's 40, you know, 40 odd years old, and he just plays third in the world overall. You know what I mean? And he's still really good. You know, there, when I first started in 2011, there's this guy Slava from, I think he's Ukrainian or Russian, one of them. And he, you know, he was 45 and still in like perfect shape. So, well, you know, that's the thing. That's what I was talking about. Like, it's sort of a fluid thing because, you know, those guys weren't necessarily doing as hard of tricks. They weren't starting at 27 meters. You know, now, like a kid that enters, like if someone wants to enter the sport, you're starting at 27 meters. And if you want to be competitive, you're starting with harder dives than they were doing like at the start of the sport. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just stepping over and over.
Right. And it's a lot like skateboarding in that sense, where like a kid watches a video and he's like, oh, if I want to be sponsored, I have to learn how to like kick flip 20 stairs or whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know?
And so it's
like the entry level is much higher than it was. And then, also, what you're seeing now is, and this is where I fall in, and a lot of the people that are starting now fall in. You know, back then it was like, okay, who's got the biggest balls and is going to jump? You know what I mean? And that's how you became a cliff diver. Now it's like there's people with, you know, I started diving at the age of 7, so I have so many years of wear and tear. There's no grassroots like program into cliff diving. Like, people start when they're done their diving career.
Right.
If you've been diving longer and you have all that wear and tear from tenure, like, you're not going to last as long, like, you know what I mean, moving forward. Like, I already have chronic back injury. I have shoulder pain. I've got, you know, some adductor injuries that are kind of nagging. So, I mean, I don't see myself doing this at 45. I don't even see myself doing this at 41. I think, you know, I've got a few more years left. I'm going to kind of take advantage of traveling the world and doing what I love and kind of just take it for what it is and just, like I said, just enjoy it.
Now, you were telling us earlier we had to reschedule the interview, and you were bringing your kid up to bed. Would you allow your kid to get into this sport, or would you be one of those, you could probably be a scientist or something, boy?
I mean, she's 10 months old. I would encourage her whenever she gets there to get into athletics of some sort. You know, I'm not going to push one way or the other. If she wanted to really get into cliff diving, like, I would just say, and it's the same advice I would give to anybody that wants to get into cliff diving. Start at your local pool. Start on 1 meter, start on 3 meter. If that's not for you, then cliff diving is definitely not for you. You know what I mean? Like, go through the basics. Train yourself to dive from 1, 3, 5, 7, or 10 meter, and then down the road, like through college, if it's something you want to do, yeah, then give it a shot. But I mean, the impact is so tremendous that I wouldn't recommend it, you know, for anybody that's not very, very serious about the sport itself. And that's kind of something also too, like, a lot of people can jump from that high. Don't get me wrong. Some people can do like have enough body control to do a flip or something, you know what I mean? But to do what we do repetitively on a competitive basis at the level we do it takes, I think, years and years of training.
Yeah. Yeah, I could talk to you for a long time. I know we got to wrap it up here. Now, you have been all over the world through diving. It looks like the sport is, like you said, growing and growing and growing. So what is in the future here? Maybe not just for you, but for Red Bull. Like, when does the season start? Are we, give us a little insight, like how we follow you and when the season starts and where we can view your stuff.
Well, in the immediate future, this coming season, we have the Red Bull season starts at the end of June.
Okay.
We were just inducted to FINA in 2013. So FINA is the governing body for aquatics in the Olympics. So, your water polo, synchronized swimming, long distance swimming, all that, anything aquatics, diving. So, it has been recognized by that governing body. And I think that's the first stepping stone to making this an Olympic sport. And I really do think that is where the sport is headed. I don't think 2020 is an option. I think maybe 2024 is probably the best spot. But yeah, like the immediate future, you can go to redbullcliffdiving.com. You can check it out. Red Bull TV is a free app you can download on, and you can go back and watch, ever since I think 2012, they have seasons. Like you can watch every stop from 2012 on and kind of catch up on the sport. And they do a really good job of kind of highlighting some of the things that first time viewers should know, or if you just want to kind of watch and get a feel for it. Following me personally, you could follow Dive Labu is my Instagram handle, or I have an athlete page on Facebook under Stephen Labu. But yeah, I think rebelcliffdiving.com is probably your first go-to, and you can really kind of learn about each of the athletes and their sort of background and get an idea for the calendar coming up and things like that, and kind of get a look at the past.
Now, has diving from these kind of heights, is there anything you're afraid of height-wise, like bungee jumping, skydiving, or does it make you want to do those kind of things?
Yeah. I've gotten into those things sort of through diving.
So I was going to say, you're almost building your way up.
Want to do that. Yeah. So I actually was fortunate enough to be in China, and I kind of crossed over to Macau, which is sort of like the Vegas of the East. But they have the world's highest bungee jump at 233 meters, which is like 600 and something feet. So that was absolutely incredible. And I actually just went skydiving for the first time with my wife a couple of years back. We're just driving down in Key West, and we're like, hey, skydive Key West, like, let's stop in. And they're like, yeah, we can fit you in right now. So awesome. It's sort of like a pullover go skydiving thing right away, which is incredible. But as far as fear goes, like, I can tell you, I get scared every single dive, every single competition, like every single time. There's no two ways around it. And if somebody wasn't scared, I would be scared for them, because at that point you know, you're going to do something stupid if you're not scared up there. You have to kind of respect how high it is, respect your fears, and that's all part of, what we do.
Now, as you traveled all over the world, have you ever been yelled at by a hotel lifeguard by not reading the no diving sign?
Yeah, more than once. Definitely. Actually, yeah, we actually got in trouble. Quick story: in college, I went to college at Purdue in Indiana, and we came down to Florida for a training trip where I am now. And they put us in a hotel on the third floor, right above the pool, and it was the dumbest thing they could have done. New Year's Eve. We had a couple drinks, and
I'm sure that's a great combination.
Yeah, definitely a recipe for trouble. So, that's part of it. That's what we live for.
So, last thing, Steve, before we go, one thing I made sure I wanted to get to. One thing I noticed, I watched a few videos of you, and Olympic diving, for the most part, there's no, from what I see, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interaction with the crowd. Kind of very serious, almost like sometimes you see with hockey, not a lot of interaction. I don't know. I think it's ingrained in the sport. I watched a few of your videos, and you seem like on your way up, you're almost pumping yourself up, looking at the crowd, you know, getting the crowd involved. Like, you're a face, and you're there, and whereas, and then you got to kind of, I guess, close it off and go into your mental zone. But it seems like on the way up, you try to get the crowd involved. Is that a thing on purpose, or am I just off base there?
No. I think you're right on key. I personally, like, when I'm there, like I said, I'm scared every time. So walking onto that platform, I can tell you, like, my heart is racing up. My knees occasionally are shaking. Like, it's that level of fear. But for me, like, kind of, just sort of looking at the view, you know what I mean? Like, we get to dive at some of the most iconic or breathtaking, awe-inspiring places in the world.
Right.
And so to just look out and really truly appreciate where you are and what you're doing and what got you there. For me, that's a very, it's a zen-like moment for me to just appreciate a view that, like, very, very few people in the world are ever going to get to have. And, mm-hmm. Like I said, for me, so I'm fully into it. Like, kind of feed off the energy of the crowd, feed off of the view and how fortunate we are to do what we love for a living. For me, that's the way to go.
I think that's awesome. Steve, thanks so much for more than a few minutes of your time. We wish you the best of luck in the upcoming season. And, this was a lot of fun. Thank you.
I really appreciate it, guys. And, just spreading the word about the sport and spreading the love.
Steve, thanks so much. That was a lot of fun, man.
Pleasure, man.
Dude, no worries, guys. Take care.
Adios. Jersey strong, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ciao.
You didn't seem that happy when I said Jersey strong. He's like, yeah. I've been to nice places.
Yeah, that's neat.
That was a
I actually
interview.
Did a minor cliff jump when I was in Bulgaria.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I've done a few cliff jumps.
Yeah, like, well, jumping off. Probably 10 feet in the air, I would probably say. A decent amount.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've done probably, I don't know, 25, 30 feet, something like that. And then the one on Mountain Creek's pretty high.
Never been there.
I've done a few of them. I did some of them when I was in Scouts. We went cliff jumping. But cliff, the idea of going ass over tea kettle, like, mm-hmm. head down, flipping. Like I said, that I still remember that time in Wildwood, blowing my back out. Oof. Like, just being like coming up to for air. Like, no! Like, just instant pain. No.
You just instantly think, I'm dead.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm dead.
There's no way I'm going to bring my breath back. I'm going to die at sea.
Just drown me. Let's take a quick break. So, Mike, you're looking a little tan.
Yeah, got a little color on me.
You got a little color. You're back from Disney.
Yeah, Florida. Was down there
full for week.
Full week, yeah.
Full week in Disney World.
Not full week in Disney World.
You did a couple things.
I did a couple days with the parents down at the
That's the way to do it. The way to do it is to move around. Like, I can't stay, like, unless it's like somewhere where you're relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could stay in one place. But when it's like, when you're at restaurants all the time, buying things all the time, and bars and rides, I can't imagine staying there for a full week. It would drive me nuts.
No, probably would, yeah.
So you saw the parents.
Saw the parents, yep. Things are going well down there.
In Georgia, or you met them in Florida?
Florida. Okay. They got the, it's kind of a retirement home in Florida. My dad wants to be there full time. The mother, she's just not into the Florida scene for some reason, so... they're down there for about 3 months. I'll head back to Georgia, and the hope is they move up to Jersey sometime later this year.
Nice. Yeah, that'll be good for you.
Yep.
See the parents often.
Yeah, it was pretty good, you know. Nice retirement home. I played some old people games, you know, some pinochles, some baton.
Baton? I don't even know that game.
Baton is basically...
We go around the track and you...
No.
You guys have a...
It's a full-day event. Only 100 meters, but it's a full-day event.
So it's you, your dad, Izzy, and your mom, and you guys keep trying to break your time.
Yeah, we faced a Jamaican team. Didn't do too well. That Usain Bolt guy, you know, he's decent. I'd watch out for him.
A baton. We pass it around over and over and over again, beating our times.
Mm. Baton is basically a bocce game used with steel balls instead of the plastic balls.
Okay.
And It's pretty much the same premise. They have kind of like a sandy kind of like lot where you have to throw like a little, what they call the pig, the ball to get closest to, and then you have to throw it kind of, instead of underhanded, you have to turn your hand around and lop
flip it
like
kind of
like
a
flip it like that.
Some people throw horseshoes like that, which I always found interesting.
But that's pretty fun and all. I mean, it's kind of like golf where you're like, all right, you got to figure out the course, how fast the sand is, and where your ball goes. So that's a pretty fun game, you know. Then went to Sunday night. We went down.
You are 40 now, so you have to transition into the old people games.
I got to be honest. I was having so much. I'm like, I want to retire. You know, I'm missing the money thing.
The money thing, future plans, all that kind of stuff.
No, I'm just going to go down there. Gonna wing it, baby. I'm going to wing it. But, saw some gators down there. Did the, what do you call those fan boats?
Fan boats. Swamp boats. Boats.
They had some large gators, and we saw one that they average about 80, they figure it was about 85 years old. Wow. Big son of a gun, so... guy was kind of into his job and all. He'd go like right into the weeds and stuff like that. He's like, I can't find these damn gators. I'm trying to get one of the young ones because it pisses off the big ones, and when they start hissing at you, it's fun. And
yeah, I mean, when I did that in New Orleans, like, I mean, they're not normal people.
No, they have their own world.
They go and look for gators every day. And
that's their whole life.
Half of them have like gator bites and scars. Mm-hmm. And this guy's like, I lost half my finger, Mom. I'm bringing
this. All right.
Look at this one. He just like pulls one out. And
yeah.
Did they feed him marshmallows when you were there?
He didn't have any feed for them. Mm-hmm. He knew the right areas. I mean, apparently where they are at, it was like prime area. It was a tour off of a farm where they had the lake and... Mm-hmm.
When I was in New Orleans, they were throwing little marshmallows. But it was like a lot of the smaller ones would come for the marshmallow. Mm-hmm. But he said they see it and they just come for it. They love
it. Yeah. When we see these small games, like, I ain't looking for those. I'm only caring about the big ones.
It's funny. He sounds like you when you were in my, yeah.
It's the only way I could figure the best imitation of him.
Well, it's good because usually your imitations sound like a Russian guy. So that one didn't sound like a Russian guy.
Thank you.
No, we're moving on up.
Woo! Sunday, went down to Disney Springs.
What's Disney Springs?
Disney Springs is
Now, I have not been to Disney since I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
Okay, so we're talking 20 years ago.
I would literally say probably in the same realm of when the last time
probably
I was
more
down
than
Disney World. But we check into the resort, and Disney Springs is kind of like the adult restaurant attraction area. So they have
like adult Mickey and adult Minnie.
Take me. S&M.
Let me just put on my white hands real quick. Okay.
But they had the, like, adult restaurants, you know, they had the boathouse. I went into an amphicar.
A what?
Amphicar.
Amphicar.
Yeah. They were made between 61 and 67, and they were made to both drive on the roads and be a boat.
Like an amphibious vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That was pretty neat, you know.
You were able to drive it?
No. They had their own driver, but... It was kind of a neat setup, and I mean, you're in like pretty much like an old Chevrolet, and then all of a sudden you're just diving in the water and it's cool. Just motorboating around, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So that was
all right. Disney Springs, night. The adult Disney.
Yeah, that was a fun night. I mean, it's more laid back.
Get on my face, see what springs up.
Stop it, Mickey.
We don't have the license to do that, Scott. We might have to delete that out. Okay. They're pretty bad about stuff there.
All right, so now Disney. Now, when you chose Disney, now I know your girlfriend was very pumped up about Disney. Mm. Were you pumped up about Disney?
I was looking forward to the vacation.
Well,
I mean,
any
even
vacation.
Yeah, the parents even said, I mean, they were there a couple times 2 years ago, and it's just a fun experience and whatever. I mean, I won't say like... Oh, 2 weeks. Girlfriend was like 9 weeks. 9 weeks. That's what kind of died down my excitement. It's like, all right, if I feed into you,
right.
we're not going to have any conversations
right.
until February. So.
Okay.
But let's see. First day was the Hollywood Studios. Very good. I highly recommend that. Best ride there was the Aerosmith ride, but the idiots there don't know how to run the lines.
That's
there.
That's Disney, the Hollywood Studios?
Yeah. They bought MGM and they made it Disney Hollywood Studios.
So the Aerosmith, I think when we went, there was an Aerosmith ride, possibly.
I would say it's a roller coaster equivalent to Space Mountain where they shoot you out and it's just a dark. And the difference is they would like light up like neon signs. So you're like going through the Hollywood sign and then going. Then in complete darkness, and then you'd see like a guitar come through. And
yeah, that sounds really familiar, but I don't know if that was there like 20 years ago.
Probably not. I mean, but then again, Aerosmith was there 20 years ago.
But then again, Aerosmith, yeah, I mean, they haven't been popular since.
Nah, they got their money. They
oh, yeah. Well, it'd be great if like Steven Tyler, like you had to go through his lips, like,
Well, the first part of the ride is they put you in, like, a big theater, and they do, like, the fake thing where they'll have, like, guitars and whatever, and they'll have a movie in the back. It's Aerosmith. And then their manager comes in, guys, we have to go to the concert. Oh, man, but we're trying to have a good old time with these people. It was, like, the cheesiest, crappy movie, and all right, I'll get them backstage.
Now, is there still like maybe that was at Universal, the earthquake thing, like there's an earthquake ride.
I did not go on that. I think that's Universal Studios. That was my last day. They had the Hollywood horror one with the, cool, but it was kind of lame.
Now, Disney, what are the lines and crowds like?
We went with FastPass, so a lot of the times we can kind of get through.
Now, what FastPass, it obviously gets you ahead of the line, but how much more is it? Is it worth it?
I'd say it's worth it. I mean, the one sucky part is, like, in Universal, you get the FastPass, you just go up to the line and show and you go in. With Disney, you have to schedule out your ride, so you can schedule out three rides, and then after that, they allow you one at a time to schedule out. So that's a one backfire, but I would still say it's worth it because the bigger rides, like the Aerosmith one, we forgot the Fast Pass on it, and then we sat there for like an hour 45.
See, I couldn't do it.
And well, the worst part was when we went there, the sign said 30 minutes, and then when we got in the line and we were moving a little bit. I got on the app, and then all of a sudden it says, our 105-minute wait.
This is why I don't think I'd be good in Disney. I don't like crowds. I don't like waiting on lines. So I don't know if I'd be good.
I will say, after a while, I mean, being a tall guy, I got long legs. I did that kind of, pretty much the entire vacation, do that shuffle walk kind of thing, where you got to stride, and then somebody, and then you just got to skid your feet and you just go and you gotta try to get past them, and then when you get a little opening and all, somebody else just crosses in your way and
now are the characters out everywhere, like do they look?
Mickey and Minnie, you have to do like a special line for that. It took 30 minutes to go see them because everybody in the world would try to take their pictures with them, but like the minor ones, the Goofy, the Chippendale, the Donald Duck.
The slaves.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
The subordinates of
Mickey. Right. Now, did you... Basically, I feel like you took enough pictures where I followed
To be
you.
Fair, the woman requested
right.
the pictures. You know me. If I do one selfie, that is an accomplishment in three quarters.
Yeah.
Her, it would be like, all right... Because she got the memory maker.
Yes, this is what I wanted to get into.
Okay.
So there's these photos, like we're seeing all your photo posts on Facebook, all of them. And
it never ends.
Yeah. So they're popping up, and some of them got Tinkerbell like in them and balloons and shit that weren't there. And first off, I'm sitting there thinking like, well, maybe there's some kind of app they're downloading. But then the other thing I'm thinking is like, they must have the patience of saints to go ask a million people to take these pictures. I'm like, there's got to be something here that
they have people at specific locations for the memory maker photos.
Gotcha.
So
freaking Disney thinks of everything.
Yeah, and their cameras are connected to their network, and they pretty much know what they can add to the photo. So at times it'd be like, put out your hand and act like there's something there. So you got to give the surprise look, and then you look at the picture later. Oh, it's cup from Beauty and the Beast on my hand.
Right.
Look at that.
Cup? Was that his name?
I think. Or is it Chip? Or?
Chip. Not Cup.
Well, he was a cup.
It's Thermos.
It's Mug. Oh, look at Mug.
It's Cup and Plate and Chandelier.
I didn't take pictures with Fork. I hate that guy.
Yeah. Okay, so, all right, that clears them up.
Now, I mean, to add to it, like, when we went to Magic Kingdom, that was the second day, it's like, all right, we see the photographer there for, you know, get your picture in front of the cast. Okay, that's, everybody does that. Fine, honey.
Right.
Take five pictures. So we start moving up because it's closer to opening. It's like, oh, there's a person taking pictures that's closer to the castle. So obviously we have to redo every single picture.
So let's preface this for the audience here. Huh. Your girlfriend is very picture. She loves pictures.
Yeah, if you very heard, lovable woman.
If you haven't heard these episodes before, yeah. There's a running joke called the kissing wall.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically if you took all the pictures they took and you put them in a flip book and you went, you'd see their whole vacation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We could basically be there with you.
Yeah.
The interactive Burloo experience. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're saying there was all these pictures basically every step of the way.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, at any point, are you like, enough? Like, do you...
It was...
Or are you trained at this point?
It was our anniversary week. It was Valentine's week, and her birthday falls on Valentine's Day, so my lips were bleeding, putting my teeth down, not saying a word, because, Lord, I mean, that part right there, when I was just like, are you kidding me? We just did, what do you mean they're closer? And then when we exit, oh, it's nighttime photo time, and we go back to the same people again. Oh,
now, do you feel weird when you like kiss in front of someone? What do they tell you? Like look in their eyes, or do you guys? Well, are you programmed to do that immediately?
Well, we kind of have a set one because I once did a picture. What she didn't know, like she was posing, and I was looking at her, and you know, I love my girlfriend. She's a beautiful woman. I'm staring at her face, and she, oh, that's a beautiful picture. So now every time it's like, oh, now it's the staring picture. Now let's pose.
So you
now
you,
there's a kissing.
You basically
picture.
Have like blue steel, like Zoolander has blue steel, different poses. You
uh-huh.
guys, that's exactly what I thought about. You guys probably are like, okay, kiss, eyes, snuggle, you know, like hug,
uh-huh.
side. They could probably bang you out in like a couple minutes. Like okay,
they could, but they never no. do.
Listen, we got eight poses.
Yeah.
We do. You just go for the ride. Mm-hmm. All right. Now my favorite picture that I saw.
Okay.
Which I gotta bring up.
Go ahead.
The hand heart picture.
Okay. Okay.
You gotta tell me what was going on. Now, was this an idea of yours or the photographer said?
It was a photographer the first time it was the photographer. When they're like, all right, position your hands. And I'm just like, what the hell are you doing? They're like, all right, put your top hand out and press it up. And what the? And it came out weird because I'm much taller than her, and so there's like me like hovering, like leaning in, like I'm about to fall, like she's catching me, and then in the end it's like, I guess that does look like a heart. She loves the photo, so then it's like, oh, Epcot, heart.
Oh, team heart.
I'm like, no, can we come up with something else? And there was like one for... Like, after the third day, and I've probably walked about 25 miles in the 3 days of walking, they're like, oh, do a pose where you're holding each other and put your leg up. And, like, my leg is shivering in the air as I'm trying to hold it up. I'm like, Damn picture. Take the damn picture.
So at no point were you like, okay, enough. You bit your tongue the entire week. There has to be one point you're like,
no.
Oh, my God, that pictures.
No, I did just on the fact of that week. If it was any other week, I'd be like, babe, enough. I mean, I did get frustrated at one time because Barry, it's an expensive vacation.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Like,
yeah.
I mean, just one day at a theme park, one day Great Adventure is insane. Like, everything.
You want to guess what the most expensive park was for me?
The parking lot?
No. Because we got shuttles from the resorts, but
what are the out of the three parks? You mean?
Well, I guess I'll just give you the answer is Universal Studios.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because with the Disney thing, at least since we were staying at the resorts, it's like, all right, you get certain prices for each day, and we're going for 3 days, so you know they've reduced the prices. Universal. They put up a charge for a one-day pass, which is about $150. Then they say
$150 a person.
$150 a person.
$150 a person.
They don't stop there. Then they say, "Well, you're at the Isle of Fantasy, but there's
where money is pretend. Yeah. Spend it."
So they apparently there's the Island of Adventure. That's what it is. Oh. And Universal Studios actually on the other side where you take a train over there. So if you want to do both, that's another charge, which put it up to about $190. Then add to it, I have to get the Fast Pass because this is our one day. They're pretty busy there.
Wait. So one night. So you guys are already at $360 between the two of you?
$380. But we'll add to it because
that's insane.
Because I need to get Fast Pass because it's large crowds. I want to hit my roller coasters. Only way I'm going to do that, since we know this is our last day, is to do that with Fast Passes. My whole day cost me $520.
That's insane. That's insane. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Like, it's almost like, to me, if I was spending that much, it would almost suck the joy out of it. I'd be like, I'd be mad before I even when I was going around.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
I love the roller coasters,
and it had to be done. It's one of those, okay, this is a one-time thing. But yeah, I was just kind of like, oh.
That's insane. For that much money, I can go up to Lake George for 6 days almost.
Yeah. You know? To add to it, she had some child friends show up, and all they was a person
she
who
She had
was,
a child?
No.
Oh.
No, that comes later. But
on a vacation? Oh.
No. No, that shit was wrapped up, but I digress.
Oh, good. We bought the Mickey condoms. They were $20 a piece.
Put me in here.
This is great. They laughed the whole time. Oh.
Genius for Spot.
But she had friends of her mom's show up there, so they were around my parents' age, late 60s, early 70s, and the one guy who was with us, unfortunately, he has cirrhosis of the liver, so he doesn't go out as is to certain places. Then we're like, all right, first ride, the Incredible Hulk roller coaster. That he had glaring eyes the entire day. You could tell that he wanted nothing to do with that place, and he was only going there out of niceness. I felt so bad for him. Like, even in the photos, I'm like, oh my God, you are in such misery. But I will say Universal Studios had the best rides.
The best ride. What was the best ride?
I would say the Hulk roller coaster. Right off the bat, my first thought is, so Disney owns that, and they're cool with you guys. They had to get the contract before they bought them.
Yeah, that's true. It'd be funny if you started with clothes, and then at the end of the Hulk roller coaster, you had none. Like, it's all ripped. They're like, ha! Now you have to buy. Now go to the gift shop to buy shirts.
So that was another $240.
All I have is these shorts left.
Why did I wear purple shorts here? What the hell?
This fucking place. But overall, a good, satisfying trip.
Very much so. Very much so.
Any what about the people at Disney? I'm expecting a lot of white trash, a lot of foreigners.
Tons of foreigners. I heard so many different languages down there. It seemed like every five steps, it was somebody else, somebody talking German, somebody talking Mandarin, somebody talking Slovak or something like that. People are right. On her birthday, we did the fireworks slash dessert show. So we had sampled a bunch of desserts, and then
that's when the desserts explode, right?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Best thing ever.
This chocolate cake, look at it go.
The molten lava cake is exactly that.
Yeah. Don't touch it, honey.
No.
But they brought us out, and they have like the gated area, so they brought us right to the front of the Magic Kingdom, and we saw fireworks over there, so that was cool. She made some friends there with people who I call professional Disney vacationers, where
Mickey, Minnie, Donald.
No, I mean, I'm talking about two people who are just literally every year. It's like, oh, we're here for this year's trip, and they just dive into Disney stuff.
Hmm?
They're good people, but you could tell it's just like they're the kind of people that's like, oh, no, the best time to go to that ride's at 2:43 when, you know, you can see Mickey in the distance and we got the buffets here and we know the back door to the Magic Kingdom, so we can get into some secret areas. And it's just...
Now, pre-trip, you were like, I'm not wearing ears, not doing it.
Uh-huh.
And then I think you lasted about 36 hours, and the years
that was kind of, well, the most aggravating part was like, all right, I know in one day I can get a certain amount of rides in,
right?
Because I'm a ride guy,
right?
When I'm big on Six Flags,
ride or die,
yeah. So when it's like, all right, I want to get to the next ride, it's like, oh, but we haven't got your ears yet. I'm like, babe, there's 20,000 people in here. I don't want to sit behind them to go to It's a Small World. Let's get the ride in and then worry about it later. And but eventually she found the store with the male ears, and the only way to put it.
Yes.
But I will tell you, my favorite moment was as I'm eating all this Disney food, my stomach was not cooperating with me at times, and also we were in the line for the Monsters, Inc. comedy show. And
oh, did you? You did 10 minutes up front?
No.
Oh, oh.
But
you've seen him on the Monsters, Inc. comedy show. Opening for Sully.
But, I mean, it's one of those... they do, you know, the video. Everybody's in like a big amphitheater, and then you walk you into your seats, and they do the show. And I had like horrible gas, and on I kind of let one go, and I walked away. And the guy behind me literally go, "Whoa!" And Izzy knew it was me because I blew one earlier and on another ride, which she kind of said the same thing. But she didn't. She wanted to say something at the same time. She's like, I didn't want him to know I was dating you and get embarrassed.
Yes. Mike Grabowski is dead. That was his name, right? Mike Grabowski? Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. The one-eyed green one.
So I'm glad you're back, buddy. Glad you had a good trip. Was there anything that you...
Oh, I got one more other thing to share about the trip. So on the day coming back, my flight, we're sitting there. We got there early. Had a 5:20 flight. It's about 4:30. We're getting close to boarding time, whatever.
So you were like, we'll be home at like 8:30, 9 o'clock.
Yeah, something like that. Sitting there. We're sitting there. And I see people are taking out their camera phones and staring out at the window. Air Force One just took off right in front of us. I'm like, huh. Yeah,
I didn't even know Air Force One took off from, like, the public airports. Like,
yeah. So, yeah, I saw it. I'm like, oh, that was kind of cool. That's, I didn't think I would get that experience. Then 5 minutes later, I'm like, I'm kind of surprised my flight's not delayed because Air Force One just took off here. Bing, Expedia. Hour and 50-minute delay.
Yeah.
And basically, from what I understand, he wasn't even scheduled. Basically, the plane was there. He didn't take off. Yeah,
he
with
was
the
doing
plane.
Rallies or whatever.
Yeah, he was doing rallies.
He was campaigning again down there.
And they were like, well, he requested the plane to take off to pick him up at another airport. So, killed 2 hours, finally got on the plane, starting to back up a little bit, all of a sudden just stops. And they're like, well, Trump decided he wanted to get picked up over here, so we got another 30-minute delay before we can take off. Because they had to wait. When Air Force One takes off, no other airplane could be in the vicinity of it, so... Mm-hmm. So he cost me half the night.
Bastard. Trump. Bastard. Damn you, Trump.
Mm.
Nah. But
I'm with her.
Yeah. No, Zoltan. Zoltan. yeah, so it sounds like you guys have a... But was there any, like, part of, like, you... Like, I picture Disney, like... Is there anything that was so overly, like, commercialized that you're like, come on, like, I gotta buy this, like... Like, or, like, when you got home, did you feel like, oh, my God, thank God I could, like, cook my own food and, like, not buy every meal? That's how, sometimes that's how I feel when I go out. It's nice to come home sometimes. Like, be like, I could put something on the oven, you know?
I guess the most commercial thing, the one time I kind of grumped in front of Izzy was when, after all those photos, she's like, well, we have to get the Disney World frames to our picture.
Yeah.
And she,
probably $45 a piece.
Pretty. She like grabbed three, and I heard $130.
So I was almost
pretty much spot on.
Almost on $5 off.
Yeah. and they give you like magic bands to open up your. It's like a wristwatch. It's plastic, but it'll open your hotel room. You can pay for stuff with it. It's connected to your credit card.
God, Disney. It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's great technology. I couldn't believe it, but in the end, it helps you spend more. So
pretty soon, like with Zoltan, like you're just gonna like literally just show up and be like, boop 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 boop, scan everything, and like your debit card's gonna be attached to your your thumb or your wrist or something. You know?
I was waving. I wasn't purchasing anything.
No. Well, it's good to have you back, buddy. I just. Well, let's get out of here. I would just tell you a quick story.
All right, go ahead.
Today, just when I thought the case of my dumbs, my stupids was going away, I feel like the fog has cleared a little bit in my head. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, I felt very dumb the last couple of weeks. Go back and listen. But so you know those little flosser things? They're not.
Yeah.
The little tiny like.
The tiny green, it's like green plastic with one strand of dental floss.
Exactly. So Alex bought a bag of them, and I go to try to floss my teeth. And I'm not a big flosser. I always forget to floss, stuff like that. And I've had a million teeth problems in my life. Like, my front tooth is half fake. I've told this on the podcast a million times. Knocked my teeth out. So I go to floss, put the flosser in today, and I go to do my two front teeth, and I get it in. And I can't get it out. I can't get it out. And every time I pull it, I feel like I'm going to pull like half the cap of my tooth off. So there I am, sitting there with half the flosser hanging out of my mouth. Like, and it's just like, oh, yeah, like, what do I do? And I can't pull it out. So I'm like, I'm wandering around with the flosser looking for the scissors. Like, where are the scissors in the thing? And I'm walking around, I'm like, yeah. And eventually I have to cut the string and then, like, pull out the back of the flosser because it would not come out. I wouldn't come out.
All right, number one, you're not going to believe this.
Then I pictured, like, being home. Like, I was coming, like, hey, man. I'm like, hey. Like, with the flosser hanging out. But
I guess if you put enough flossers in there, they got the pointy ends. It could be a good weapon, and if you get into a fight,
I was. It's funny. I was actually thinking that because I took one on the way to work because I was just, flossing in the car. I was like, this edge is really pointy. Like they cannot allow these in prison. Like there's no. They can't give these guys.
That's the worst thing in prison. I actually looked it up. That's the biggest complaint from inmates.
But
I mean, I get raped in the shower, but the worst thing, I can't get that corn out of my teeth.
I would love to talk about The Walking Dead, or as I call it, just horrible. Dead Air. Let's get into that next week. It's too late. We've been talking forever.
Yeah.
Who knows what even ends up on this episode, but anything to promote, Berlo, let's get the hell out of here.
I will promote March 1st at the Oak Barrel, 8:30 starts, Rich McDonald, Kevin Grifo, Jackie Byrne, and Mr. Michael Berlo as well.
Oh, Michael Berlo coming out of retirement.
Yep.
That's good.
I'm kind of like Deion Sanders. I retire, come back. Cup of coffee, go back to studio work. So.
Yep.
Okay. And, of course, facebook.com/TheBurl721. Tonight on The Walking Dead, Lord, I'm going to trash him for last week.
Trash him for everything.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go, anybody down the Jersey Shore, March 3rd, I'm going to be in Lefty's in Barnegat, New Jersey. Lefty's in Barnegat, New Jersey. So... with all that said, guys, please listen to the podcast. Please vote for us on Podcast Land. We'll try to win that again, maybe. Real skeptical. We were winning, and then 95 votes came in for the other podcast.
Yeah, but they were like at 40, then magically.
But listen to us on Stitcher, iTunes. The Laughable app is pretty awesome. You can listen to us on Google Play, TuneIn, and also... I love how I do all these promotions. All you really have to do is Google Verbal Shenanigans, and you'll find it.
Yeah.
So go
and
back.
We're in a podcast tournament. Also.
We are. I haven't heard anything about it yet. So, yeah, but we'll.
I declare us the winner.
Yeah, we won that. So
yeah.
But
in your face, whoever we were facing.
We will talk about that more next week. We got to get the hell out of here. Yeah. Zoltan Esteban, vote for him. Listen to him. And Stephen LeBoux.
I don't know what he's running for, but vote for him, too.
Check that out. Good night, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the win. Absolutely. Stripes, but you know he's clean.